House Committee on Judiciary comes to
order. Today is February 18th, 2009. The first item on the agenda is House Bill 2127. Mr. Taylor, you want to give us a quick rundown, please?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2127 comes to you from the Department of Human Services, and it basically, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, allows the Department of Human Services in a contested case hearing to give notice by regular mail. Establishes if DH issues notice in contested case hearing, the notice automatically becomes a final order against the party. If party fails to request a hearing in the time allowed, DHS or the Office of Administrative Hearings issues an order dismissing the hearing request because the other party would do the request for a hearing or the party did not appear at the hearing.
Okay, Ms. Gasper, please.
Chair Barkhart and members of the committee, I'm Kim Gasper. I'm the Administrative Role Coordinator for the Department of Human Services. I'm here on to testify in support of House Bill 2127. This bill was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Department of Human Services. Under current law, ORS 183.415, DHS is required to send contested case decision notices by registered or certified mail. DHS sends out about 3 million notices by regular mail each year. This volume far exceeds that of other state agencies issuing notices that can lead to contested case hearings. House Bill 2127 would provide an exemption to allow DHS to continue a long-standing practice of sending these notices by regular mail instead of certified or registered mail. In addition, currently the law 183.470(2) requires that a separate final order be sent to clients who do not request a hearing or miss the deadline for requesting a hearing after receiving a contested case notice decision. House Bill 2127 would also provide for DHS's current practice of not sending a separate final order when a client fails to request a hearing or files a late request for hearing. If House Bill 2127 does not pass, the department-wide cost to begin using certified mail would be over $16 to $21 million for the 09-11 biennia. In addition, it would be $36 million for the 09-11 biennia to issue separate final orders. About 52% of these costs would be covered by federal funds, but it would still cost over $25 million in the next biennia in state general funds for DHS to follow the same process used by state agencies with comparatively small number of notices. DHS is currently working with the Oregon Law Center on some amendments to clarify that DHS's process will not change. The fiscal impact statement that was provided by LFO will indicate additional general funds needed if the bill does not pass. Thank you for your time and allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
On this bill, it's my understanding that while the law has said you're supposed to do the registered mail or whatever, certified mail, that you have not been doing that for 34 years. So what you're asking is to continue the existing practice. Is that right?
An exemption for DHS to send them by regular mail.
You're asking for an exemption, but you've been doing it by regular mail for the past 34 years?
That's correct.
So we're just going to be continuing the existing practice and that somehow that got missed 34 years ago.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krieger.
Talk to me about $3 million. You don't have that many clients. I mean, are you sending 5 or 6 or 7 a year to one person or 10?
It could be. It's either you've been approved for benefits, denied, your benefits have changed, you've created an overpayment, your medical services are denied. So many clients could receive more than one. They could receive several notices.
The number just seems huge.
Yes,
Stigler.
And I'm aware that that's been the usual practice in a lot of the fairly standard kinds of processes and services, notices that you send out. I'm just curious. what sort of brought this to this sort of bubbling point?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I believe that in 2007 there were three or four cases that were taken to the Court of Appeals, and when the AG looked at those and said there's no evidence that these were served either by registered, certified, or personal, you could have inadequacy of service, and the Court of Appeals would rule on that and not on the merits.
Which I guess then sort of leads to my next question, and I understand the volume. I know the myriad of things that this could potentially apply to. I'm not sure that, well, back up. Has the AG assured you that with this provision it would then obviate that problem, that there would not then be that potential argument is I didn't receive service, I didn't receive the notice?
Representative Barker, Representative Stiegler, there is a provision that could possibly be added to this in working with the Oregon Law Center on that non-receipt of something served by regular mail, so we're hoping to make sure that that's clarified.
Okay, Representative Wissnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gasper, my concern is I think there's certain issues in DHS. You want to be sure that person received it. You know, they're talking about custody or something like that. I can understand if they're going to be receiving benefits, I'm sure they're going to look for the mail and going to find it. But it just seems like, I want to be sure that the people get notice that are looking at custody hearings or something like that you're working on, or hearings or something like that. So I think I would prefer to have some sort of the little cheaper green slip or something like that. Not a blanket authority for DHS. You know, certain cases, I think we really would like to have a receipt.
And Chair Barker, Representative Wissnant, this is a May served by regular mail, and so I think that certain cases would fall into that category where it was very important to send it by certified mail.
Excuse me, Chair Barker, if I could. For the record, I'm Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. I do want to explain that our advocates, we have many, many advocate groups that are involved in all of the things we do with our clients. And they are, while we're working with the Oregon Law Center as an advocate group on some amendments, they've been very supportive all along of our clients getting our notices by regular mail. And actually, I know that this sounds wrong, but they would tend to open a regular envelope before they would accept and sign for something. I know that sounds opposite of what, but because of sometimes the what's going on in their lives, they are much more likely to just open a regular envelope and not want to sign the little green thing about where they actually live. And they do move a lot, so we go out of our way. They sometimes let us know their address before they let anybody else. But so it's not just a matter of the cost, although that's always an indication of how we like or don't like a bill. But it really is also that this is better for our clients. They will receive more notices this way than they probably would if they had to sign.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I agree. I think this is a good bill. It doesn't get you much these days to try to do something certified in my experience. But I want to make sure that what's good for the goose is also good for the gander. I assume that you contract with a lot of nonprofits who have to give notices out to either patients they're terminating or clients they're terminating. And do you know if DHS requires any of those agencies to notify people certified mail? And if you do, perhaps should this be afforded to the nonprofits you contract with?
Representative Barker, Representative Shields, they would be under the same obligations that we would, especially in a contested case. People don't contest a case to a managed care organization. They contest it to us. So the notification, my guess, would go out from both of us that you're no longer a part of this managed care organization, and we're the ones that terminate them.
Okay.
Because of eligibility or perhaps a family got their children taken away, so now they're no longer eligible for food stamps because they have no children in the house. We have the children, so we let them know that they're no longer eligible, or their food stamp amount has gone down, and we make that notice.
In contested cases.
Correct.
I mean, if, I guess.
Or, I mean, a notification of the change in benefits.
Okay. All right. So the broader point I'm getting at, though, is would you require any of the organizations that you contract with to
yes, we do.
To file by registered mail?
Oh, no. They have to do it the same way we do it.
Okay.
We would not require them to do it. We pay the bill either way. I mean.
Right, but it's a challenge for some of the nonprofits to get to the post office by it, and I just
want
to make sure on the record that you're saying you don't require
them
to
my knowledge,
that.
We do not require them to do anything differently than us.
Great, thank you.
In having been doing this for 34 years, I'm assuming you feel it's working. Is that right? I mean, it's you're not having great difficulties with it, or are you having some troubles?
Chair Barker, that's kind of the reason that I jumped up, not that Kim can't answer some of these questions. Some are more policy in nature, and Kim's the technical expert, but I love to be up here. No, we're not having a problem with it. There are going to be people who claim they didn't get their notice. And, in fact, some of them know they got their notice, and some of them really didn't get their notice. In a domestic violence case, they may have left the house and they're staying in a shelter and they didn't get notice. They go into the doctor and all of a sudden they say, you've been cut off. And they're like, whoa. So they appeal. Now, we, within our rules, have what we call a late appeal notice, and our advocates, they like our rules, they like the way we handle it, and we do give people, because of the types of lives some of our clients are unfortunately living, we have to have sort of a flexible way for people to appeal so that if they really were fleeing a domestic violence situation, we wouldn't hold that against them. We would then bring them back in and say, okay, let's look at your case again. And their appeal rights, they could get an appeal just on the fact they say they didn't get it, and then they can get a hearing on the merits of the case, too. So I think it's working well. I don't think we don't intend to change anything. We intend to codify in law what we've been doing for 37 years, actually. And my understanding, the only thing we can come up with is why nobody has caught this is because of some names that we called things that weren't in the APA, but in fact they were the same thing. So. And excuse me, Chair, but we did put a pop in for this in our agency request budget to actually pay for the postage, and it was not put in the GRB, and it was to the tune of what Ms. Gasper talked to you about.
Okay, thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Hibb?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. Thank you. To make a brief comment, we do have concerns about the way the bill is currently drafted, but absolutely agree with the intent to codify the current practice, and so we're working with the department to come to an agreement about language that we agree does, in fact, codify the current practice. The concern that I think we all share, that the desire to make sure that notice is effective, and that's what we're working on. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I should ask any questions. Please.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2127 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2139. Modifies the grounds for the court to order appointment of a trustee and allows for appointment of a temporary manager by Department of Human Services for long-term care facility or residential care facility. Meredith Coate and Mary Gear, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Department of Human Services. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2139. This bill is asking for a process to be able to appoint a trustee to oversee a troubled facility in an expedited manner. It also allows the department to enter into an agreement with a long-term care provider regarding a temporary manager, and finally raises the amount that the department can collect in a trustee fund for the purposes of operating a troubled facility. Currently in statute, the department has the authority to go to court and ask for a trustee to be appointed when a facility is having difficulty. There's financial difficulties or the operator is not able to meet residents' needs. In the last several years, we've run into situations where we've actually needed a trustee on an expedited basis. There was an immediate concern, or we felt that residents were in immediate danger. And the court process that we go through in order to get a trustee really made that difficult in response. And the only option we have had available in that kind of a situation is to evacuate the facility, which causes trauma to the residents and families and really isn't good for anyone. So this bill would allow the department to appoint a trustee in an ex parte and then give the provider due process and go through the court process after we've ensured that residents are safe and continuing to get the care that they need. It also allows the department to enter into a temporary manager agreement. Often we may go down the road of a revocation of a license, which can take 6 months to a year sometimes. In that situation, it may be agreeable for the provider to have a temporary manager come in to operate the facility so that they don't have that responsibility and so that the department is assured of health and safety of residents. Finally, we're asking to increase the amount of funds that are in the trustee account. Those funds are collected from providers. It's an additional licensing fee every year put into a dedicated trustee fund. And we call in those funds when necessary in order to continue the operation of a facility where a trustee has been appointed. Already submitted some amendments on the recommendation of the Department of Justice, and we've also been working closely with Oregon Healthcare Association for further amendments on some technical and legal issues in the bill, and in addition have come to agreement on a request for an amendment that would increase the limit from $300,000 to $750,000. We all have a lot of concern, especially in the current economic environment, of financial difficulties in facilities, and given the cost of our trusteeships over the last couple of years, really feel that an even higher limitation is necessary. So in closing, we support this bill and requested that it be submitted, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Are there any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So actually, you, of course, met in my office and you walked me through the bill. I had one issue with Section 15, subsection 1 in particular. You might recall that.
I do.
And I only have the dash 2 amendments. This creates a loophole by which, of course, a trustee could be appointed, and then the trustee, being the person legally responsible for facility, could then, of course, agree with the agency to appoint a temporary manager and thereby circumvent essentially judicial review of the actions. And you stated that's not your intent. I'm assuming that's still not. And so I'll assume that further amendments are coming to resolve that.
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, yes, as I said, that is not our intent to circumvent what is essentially due process for a provider.
Right.
And so I actually have our DOJ representatives here if you want a little bit more on that. But yes, we're looking at that issue for further amendments.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And what our agency does is we identify, investigate, and work to resolve the complaints and concerns of the residents of long-term care facilities. To do that, we train and certify volunteers to be a regular presence in those facilities. So with our staff and our volunteers, we're in long-term care facilities throughout Oregon every day, sometimes nights, and on weekends. And I am here, I have just very brief comments, and that is to express our support for this bill because I believe it's really important to enhance the tools that are available to the Department of Human Services to protect a very, very vulnerable population. And as Mary Gear alluded to, there is nothing more disconcerting to a person who considers a facility their home to suddenly be faced with a situation where they may have to move. And so any efforts to maintain the integrity of a facility while there are problems is something that our agency supports. And what we have found, and we've been involved in some of the circumstances of facilities that have placed resident health and safety in jeopardy, and we find that circumstances can change extraordinarily quickly in a building. So one day things can look very, very good, and another day you can be in a situation where there's chaos. And so to be able to have the the ability to do a preliminary trustee is a very valuable tool. In closing, what I would just, the only part of the bill that I would challenge, and I think Mary talked about it, is that the Section 7, which deals with the facility fund balance, the balance, I think the department seeks to increase the balance of that fund before the collections discontinue from $300,000 to $500,000. I would submit that a fund balance of $1 million is probably more appropriate in today's economic times, but also in our current economic times, where if the instability of the buildings is driven by financial instability, then that means that that fund is going to have to absorb the cost of the trustees. And with only 750, you probably could only maintain perhaps three trusteeships at any one time over a period of time if the facility itself were not in a position to absorb those costs. So with that, I'll close.
Questions for Representative Wisnant?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mrs. Gear. Mrs. Gear, I know that Ways and Means will be asking you these questions, but your fee increase, is the fees based upon the size of the home, or is each, is a home of 100 beds going to pay the same as 50 or 20? Can you address that? And I guess, too, I understand this, and I want to be sure that the money is there to take care of the people that are harmlessly affected by this, but I don't think we can go to, are you not proposing to go to $1 million? And, is there going to be like a curve? We don't want too much money there because that's driving up the cost for the people who are staying in the facility and using the facility. So,
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnant, to address your first question about the fees, it's essentially a second licensing fee, annual licensing fee. And the current licensing fees and proposed licensing fees, there's another bill, is based on the number of beds in a facility. So it is dependent on the size. As to the second part, when we first discussed this over a year ago, $500,000 seemed a reasonable amount. Since then, we've closed out a couple of trustees that we've had going. Those were relatively small facilities. One of them was a 24-resident facility. Cost close to $150,000 to run the trustee for that, which was over quite a long period of time. And so have had some discussions with OCA, representing
notifying the providers about what seems a reasonable amount to have sitting in an account, not too much, but enough to address the issues as they come up.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, please.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments. But so then, are there any things in this bill that are going to say if it gets a, you know, you reduce the fees if it gets to be a certain amount? Is it an annual fee or one time, or how does that work?
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnant, how the statute works now and what we would propose continuing is that we collect fees until the account reaches the maximum and then we stop. The other amendment that we're working on with OCA, which is a very reasonable request, is that when we send out the notification to providers that we're assessing this extra fee, that we advise them what the account balance is and what the account, what expenditures have been made out of that account in a very general sense.
Thank you very much for that information.
Representative Cameron, please.
Chair, and it's along with the representative line of questions the representative just asked. I can see where the amount, where the fee stops when it reaches a certain amount in the bill. But where is the fee outlined? It's a secondary fee, you're saying.
Chair Barker and Representative Cameron, the fees are outlined in a different part of statute, and I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Wohl, Grant, and Greenman.
Chair Barker, if I may, Mr. Grant and Mr. Wohl are from the Department of Justice. They were here in case there were any legal questions.
Oh, okay.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
They don't need to. Thank you very much.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Joe Greenman. I work with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and on behalf of the long-term care profession in the state of Oregon, we've worked very closely with the Department of Human Services in what I would call very constructive dialogue back and forth on this bill. And, you know, we've really just worked through a number of technical legal issues that were very easy, and we expeditiously worked through them. So with that, I'll just conclude my remarks and take questions, or if you have any questions,
any questions,
happy to answer them.
Greenman. Hey, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2139. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2163.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2163 comes to you from the Oregon Military Department. It establishes the appeals from the Armed Forces Court of Appeals for Oregon go directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. It allows the Adjutant General to appoint judge advocate legal assistance for a period not to exceed 12 months. Provides that the period of service members' active duty may not be included in determining any statute of limitations. Reduces from 6 months to 90 days after release from active duty the time period a member of the Oregon National Guard may seek relief from any obligation or liability occurred before active duty.
Hey, Mr. Leibel and General Caldwell, please. Already there. Good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. With me today is Captain Brian Leibel, who is a judge advocate in our department, and I brought him along for able assistance and expertise, which he has a lot of. I'll speak to a good portion of the bill and let him talk to the one that I think is probably going to be more interesting, particularly the legal the folks with lawyers with JD behind their name. The bill is fairly straightforward. It basically extends the time and some of the requirements, so we have the opportunity to appoint temporary judge advocate general corps members to the Oregon National Guard. What we have found with the deployments that and all the activity that is required that we get done with our men and women who are mobilizing, we simply don't have the staff to deal with it. The process of getting folks qualified through the Judge Advocate General process at the United States Army is sometimes slow and methodical, and we believe that we have a lot of young attorneys that can serve with us and do up to, I think it's a legal assistant in the Oregon state statutes and the ORSs, and so it would be of great benefit to us to be able to have that flexibility as we wait for them to meet these other requirements that are in the statute. That's the simple portion of the bill. The more complicated portion of it, again, while I have my JAG here, if you'll look on further back in the bill, and it talks about the Supreme Court being part of the exclusive jurisdiction over all appeals from the Armed Forces Court of Appeals for Oregon, and I think I'll let Brian speak to that because I think he can do a much better job than I could. So, Brian, go ahead and introduce yourself and talk about that.
Thank you, sir. My name is Captain Brian Leibel. I'm a judge advocate with the Oregon Army National Guard. Mr. Chair, this provision allows a further due process that in the event that there is a court-martial and it gets appealed up to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces for Oregon, which was created in 2005. This would be the final step of the due process allowing discretionary review by the Oregon Supreme Court.
Questions? Representative Stengler.
Yes, General. I had a question. Why the reduction of the application time from 6 months to 90 days?
Let me defer that to the JAG here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Stiegler, that reduction actually coincides with the Service Member Civil Relief Act and its limitation. So in order to minimize any confusion with the service member, we thought we'd go ahead and make it.
I was hoping there was a rational reason.
You
Thank
bet.
You.
Representative Barton.
Chair, Captain, a question, and just this frankly a thought and potential friendly amendment. You know, many lawyers do pro bono work, and I think would be very intrigued by this. Representative Stigler, myself, I can't vouch for Representative Garrett, but one actually, you know, very common sort of captive source of pro bono legal work is, of course, law students, particularly 3Ls, who often, you know, in almost every jurisdiction are allowed to appear in a student appearance rule. And it occurred to me that this bill actually might preclude that, and I assume that was unintentional. I was thinking actually particularly in page 1, line 17, which, for example, be a member in good standing with the Oregon State Bar, potential friendly amendment might say, or otherwise certified to appear in court. Mm-hmm. A thought.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I appreciate your comment, and you certainly have identified the class of individuals we were attempting to get at with this bill. I believe a few provisions down below where it says talk about state judge advocate legal assistance.
Ah.
This would, and this is part of our program that we have, and this would add statutory support, and where we have law clerks who are going through law school,
of course,
now have some sort of status in our organization to get on-the-job training and experience, and they have already expressed an intent to join our organization once they graduate from law school and pass the bar exam.
Thank you, Captain. I missed that section.
Representative Wisnap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General and Captain, what's the significance of deleting the term active state duty? We're just leaving active service. Is there significance in the you're deleting that from the bill now, the term active state duty, several times in the bill? Page 3, line 36 and 42 and 39.
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't. There's been several twists and turns over the last several years, predominantly starting in the Veterans Committee and chaired by your distinguished chair in the last session. And this is, and Brian, you correct me if I'm wrong, but terminology-wise, active state duty means that you're under the control of the governor, and which you are also in any form. However, it's not in what we term a Title 32 status. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
That's where you were headed with that. The National Guard is a little different than the other reserve components. Active duty personnel are entitled in U.S. Code Title 10 status all the time. The reserve components of the forces are also in Title 10 service. The National Guard, however, when they're not on federal service under the control of the governor, under U.S. Code Title 32. There's also another form, like for fires, floods, and emergencies that we activate people. The governor has the ability to activate people under the what is termed state active duty. And so I think what we're trying to do here is to lump it all in with saying active service. In other words, if you're a member of the Oregon National Guard and you're in good standing, then you are in active service of the Oregon National Guard. We're not trying to bifurcate out between all these different forms of service that you could be under, so you're still under the control of the governor under the statute. So as long as you're under the control of the governor, we're not going to distinguish between whether you're on a forest fire or whether you're on annual training at Camp Withycombe and you commit a crime or you do something there. So it basically lumps it all together, and I think that just clarifies it.
Thank you very much, sir.
Representative Garrett.
Sorry, I missed it, but the language about exclusive jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, it looks to me like it's not replacing anything that's currently there. So I'm just curious where appeals go now.
To me, no.
No.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrett, right now it just stops at the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces of Oregon. This statutory provision takes that final step to allow discretionary review to the Oregon Supreme Court and just defer that due process.
I might just add on to that just for everybody's edification. I've been in this organization now 38 years as of Saturday. I can recall one court-martial in 38 years. I don't know that there's been any before when I was a private and a corporal and that sort of thing, because I really didn't care much about that sort of thing at that age. But I think there's only been the one. And that was a mistake, quite frankly. That should have never gotten to that. Should have been handled below that. And we've changed things around to make sure that happens again. So this is pretty rare. It could happen. And we want to make sure that we got it right if it does happen. But like I say, it's a long shot.
No further questions. If you
hang on, Mr. Smith.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Smith. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Good to see you.
Vice Chair.
You may have just answered my question, or at least given me enough information that my question doesn't need answering, except for this. Do we know how the courts feel? This sounds like a good bill to me. Do we know what the Supreme Court feels about it, and are they going to elicit? Are they going to offer an opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith. I saw some emails that I think that there was some initial concerns. I think there's somebody else on the list that may want to that did sign up, but I think they have been satisfied with respect to their last concerns. I don't know if they're for or against it. I think they're neutrals, if I remember right, working on the list. So, to my knowledge, there is no opposition to that.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Miller, did you want to testify?
Council
had a
question.
Mr. Chair, remind everyone there's a set of amendments in front of you we just got, which you worked out with the courts.
Right. Those are those emails I was speaking to to get everybody happy. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Captain. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bruce Miller, Senior Staff Counsel in the State Court Administrator's Office. Hot off the press from Legislative Counselor, the -1 amendments that address the issue that we identified in the bill. We aren't taking a position on the bill, but the provision for review by the Supreme Court was pretty bare bones in here, didn't give parties much direction. And so we asked for an amendment that would establish review in the same manner that a case goes from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court under ORS 2.520, and that is what the -1 amendments do. Normally the court is not excited about direct review, but given that there will be very few cases under this, and given that it is coming from a Court of Appeals, they felt this was the appropriate way to go.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have before us the dash ones, House Bill 2163. Is there a motion to adopt those?
So moved.
Representative Smith moves we adopt the dash ones, House Bill 2163.
We in a work session?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Close the public hearing. My
work session. Representative Smith.
I so move.
Has moved 2163-1s. Is there any discussion about those? Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2163-1. Next item on the agenda is work session.
Don't have the fiscal. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we don't have a fiscal yet, the dash one amendments, and we can't move the bill until we have the fiscal and the dash one amendment.
Even though there is none.
Until
we get it back. Next opening work session on House Bill 2303, Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, one reason I was not in the room for the second bill is that I gathered all the interested parties on 2303 and sent them down to Legislative Council's office. As you know, sometimes it's difficult to get, this time of year, everyone in the same room to work out differences, I should say ambiguities in language. I believe they've come back from Legislative Council's office, and the indication I've gotten body language is that basically they have an agreement on the bill, they've resolved their minor differences in the bill, and I assume that sometime in the next few days we will have the language, and when we do, we'll put the bill back on the schedule. But I believe all the Charlie Williamson is there from the bar, and I'm sure he could give us an idea on the record if you like.
Charles Williamson, the Oregon State Bar Military Assistance Panel. Susan Gravy, Jess Barton, Paul Cosgrove, and Jim Markey, and I just met with David Hendricks. We all agreed on everything, and David says he can write it up. And I think that we'll have a bill for you very shortly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then we'll close the work session on 2303 and move to a work session on House Bill 2276. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, 2276 comes to you from the Department of Justice. It's a support enforcement bill. You may remember this bill was brought last week on the 11th. And at that time, we were under mistaken belief there was a need for an amendment for the bill. That's not the case. I talked with the parties after the hearing, and Renelle Shankle is here from the Department of Justice. So we have the fiscal on this bill, and it's ready to go if you so desire to do it.
Are there any questions about the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it relates to the assignment of, requires the Child Support Division to have an assignment of rights before providing support enforcement services.
Yes, sir. Yes, Representative Westnamp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I remember our discussions during the public hearing on this group, there was concern about having the last known address. They were going to delete that. Is that, remember in paragraph, line 10 of the first page? Was that?
I think that got resolved in that. It's last known.
So that was okay?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's the last known address, so it doesn't
ever
have
to find out. Find
out. That was my conversations in that.
Okay, will this be the consent calendar?
Yeah,
I mean, okay.
Don't see this.
Yeah. Okay. I'll accept a motion to move House Bill 2276 to the floor with the due pass.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2276 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2276 to the floor with the due pass. Should we pass the bill, I'm going to move to the consent calendar if there's no objection. Can you call the roll on the bill, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Crager?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler? Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Is there any objection to being on the consent calendar? Hearing none, so ordered. Any further business before the committee today? Hearing none, meeting adjourned. Thank you.